For 30 years, and with over 800 episodes, Mountain Stage has been a mainstay in public radio and American music.
A show from West Virginia with the name Mountain in it was not an easy sell in a lot of markets around the country.
As a collection, the work means something. He described it, and I think he's right. It's Smithsonian-grade material.
They just did what they wanted to do, and people noticed. It's valuable.
Well, shows don't last for a year or two or three, you know, so to be around 30 years is quite an accomplishment.
We would have never predicted Mountain Stage would have been here for 30 years. But one of the reasons we are is because we're constantly looking at the future. We're not looking at the past.
Over the next hour, we'll hear how the show came to be, its rise to a national program, and examine what it is that makes Mountain Stage mean so much to the artists who have performed and the audience it reaches. Hi, I'm Dave Mistich. Like anything that evolves into a lasting endeavor, Mountain Stage's success is part happenstance, mixed with years of dedication and hard work. Truly, though, it all comes down to the people who've made the show possible, coming together with a shared vision. We'll start nearly a decade before the show was even a thought. In 1972, Francis Fisher moved to Elkins, West Virginia with his family, fresh off a 9-year stint in New York City, working for NBC Radio.
I was a network engineer, and there weren't any networks in West Virginia at that time. And I just didn't think I would ever work in broadcasting again. But came a day when we got hungry, and the guy from the local radio station, WDNE, asked what I actually did in New York, and I told him.
Texas-born singer-songwriter Larry Gross also found himself in central West Virginia around the same time.
Francis was one of the people I met when I first came to West Virginia in 1972. At that time, he wasn't working for public broadcasting. He was the head engineer of WDNE, commercial radio in Elkins. And he lived, he was kind of a back-to-the-lander there, had a place outside of town. And I went down there because I was working as an artist-in-residence, National Endowment Grant, in three counties, and one of them was Randolph County. The other was for Barber and Tucker, and I lived in Barber County. And so I met Francis there because I would go on the air there to talk about my program or to actually sing with the Currents Brothers, who were a bluegrass band from down in Randolph County. No, I won't have to throw my money
away in dues on hospital plans. Radio producer and music promoter Andy Ridenour was priming his own career at then Concord College in Athens, West Virginia, before moving on to commercial radio.
I became involved in different aspects of the business and of radio, plus promoting and putting on concerts.
Thanks to a hit from Gross in 1976, he and Ridenour finally crossed paths. I open that door so slowly, take a peek up north and south. Then I pull out a Hostess Twinkie
and I pop it in my mouth. And I had met Larry. He had had a top 10 novelty hit when I was working in commercial radio in Beckley and met him in the studios there. And had an opportunity to see him on occasion. He was really good friends with Francis.
Juk Fu Juki was an oddball song to become a hit, although I knew it was popular because when I began to sing it in concert, immediately had response from a lot of kinds of people. So I always used it in the set. And I always liked to use humor and those kind of songs within my set when I was out performing, because I knew I couldn't play the guitar great, and I knew I couldn't get by just singing, you know, regular songs. So I had to throw some things in there for entertainment purposes. And one thing I could do is write some satires that made people laugh. So I always did that. And that one was the one that really hit big.
Gross began touring the country in support of Junk Food Junkie, and Ridenour joined West Virginia Public Broadcasting in 1977. Fisher also went to work for the organization in January 1978, relocating to southern West Virginia to handle television engineering. Ultimately, Fisher gravitated back toward radio.
After a couple of years in Beckley, it was decided to move the radio operation from Beckley to Charleston, and they asked me to do that, along with looking over the construction of a microwave system that would tie all of the radio transmitters together. That was my job to do the best I could with that.
Ridenour also began producing live broadcasts of local jazz pianist Bob Thompson for West Virginia Public Radio.
At the time, I was playing at the Holiday Inn, the Elk River Holiday Inn, with a trio on the weekends, and Andy Ridenour used to come down and listen. Somewhere along the line, he got an idea, well, maybe we should do a live broadcast from here. So he came down, and we did a couple of Friday night live broadcasts from that location. Andy says that somewhere out of that grew the idea to do live music.
With the infrastructure and plenty of know-how in place, West Virginia Public Broadcasting's general manager at the time, Rich Eisworth, called upon the staff for new ideas to explore as part of the statewide radio network expansion. Then news host Andy Ridenour chimed in.
First idea that popped into my head was doing a musical variety show. And Rich said, well, put something down on paper and see what you can do. And I went to, at that point, I went to Francis Fisher, who was the engineer for West Virginia Public Television and radio at that time, and asked him, did we have the capability of putting together a radio show that would be 2 hours and, multiple acts on it and multiple facets, including some comedy and bits and skits and that kind of thing. And he said, not yet, but, we can make it happen.
I said, number one, we can do it. Number two, I want to work on the project. But then there was a number three. I said, you got to get Larry Gross to host the thing.
At that time, it was going to be, they were trying to find money to do a once-a-month show in West Virginia. Because they knew that this system was going to broaden. They were going to be more towers. There were more things planned. So they knew as they had more, it would more of the state would hear it. More towers, more broadcasters.
Even during Mountain Stage's earliest moments of development, Gross had a broad vision for the program.
I felt like that I wanted to do something that was bigger than a West Virginia show. So I said to them, and it was a real thought, but it was obviously also kind of pie-in-the-sky dream. I said, let's say that we're going to do a national show based in West Virginia, and it'll start out West Virginia, obviously, but let's aim at being a national show.
Finally, the pieces were in place for a one-off live show to be broadcast around the state.
We put some stuff down on paper, and it took us a while to raise the money to do a pilot show, which we did in 1981.
Live from the Cultural Center in Charleston, West Virginia, it's Mountain Stage with Larry Gross. Co-host, the Earl of Elkview. The Little West Virginia Symphony is under the direction of Vince Lewis. Special guests for our premiere show are Bob Wolpert, the Bob Thompson Jazz Trio, and the Pickers.
Over hills, beautiful hills, how I love the West Virginia hills. If o'er land or sea I roam, still I think of happy home and my friends among the West Virginia.
And we liked what we had come up with there. We came up with a house band and had guests on the show for the pilot that included Bob Thompson.
The show at that time had a little bit different flavor. And it was all people from the area, so we all knew each other. And so there was that kind of camaraderie, because we were all friends. And there was it was music, but there were also storytelling and a lot of different things.
Despite the fact that everyone involved viewed the March 1981 pilot as a success, a lack of initial funding for continued tapings stalled regular production.
That was 1981. They didn't come up with enough money to actually planned for a season until 1983, 2 years later. Fast forward 2 years, and they said, well, we have some money now. We can do a show a month from December of 83 to December of 84.
And that's how it came to be. The December of 1983 was our first regularly scheduled program.
Live from the Cultural Center Radio Theater in Charleston, the West Virginia Department of Culture and History and West Virginia Public Radio present Mountain Stage.
Well, come up early, don't be
soon. Guests on the show included Denny Bonet and Julie Adams, billed together as the fabulous Twister Sisters.
Take it. Look what I do to you. I'm no good thing. No, I'm cold. I'm cold.
After their first appearance, the Twister Sisters stayed on as regulars for Mountain Stage and eventually became part of the house band. Here's Julie Adams.
The first show just had a bass player and a pianist as the house band, and Larry, and there was a co-host, George Doherty.
You know, I got my start on WRLX radio up at Elmview. That's relax radio, ladies and gentlemen. Did the news ever make you jumpy? You know, did you read the paper and listen to the news and just sort of get, that never happens on relax radio, I'll tell you. We're only 150 watts up there, but it's clear channel, and our motto is, if it sounds good, shoot her out there just as far as it'll go.
A colorful character known to audiences as the Earl of Elkview, Doherty acted not only as co-host, but also performed skits, monologues, and even played the saw.
It was very exciting to be a guest on the show because it was live radio. It was live in the state. So that was definitely an extra, well, you could say excitement, you could say terror.
Broadcasting live certainly made for some stressful moments for the performers and the crew, but with Fisher at the helm of mixing and engineering, the decision to produce the show live was an important one.
It's always been my belief that shows should be done live, and everybody has to be on their best behavior and just give the work their very best, and we were able to do that.
Probably a lot of us didn't quite get it then. You know, we didn't quite understand what Larry was going for in being as eclectic as he was and having, you know, a jazz band on right next to a bluegrass band.
That's John Kessler, a Charleston area musician at the time, who first appeared on the show in February 1984 with local band Rhino Moon, and again in April of the same year with Stark Raven.
As time went by, we saw, oh, okay, Larry is really kind of, you know, bringing all the different types of music in here. And that took a while to, you know, for me to understand.
In its earliest stages, the show featured local and regional musicians from the Charleston area and elsewhere around West Virginia. At the time, says Gross, it was simply a matter of resources.
We put people on there, whoever we could get, obviously, anybody from around the state or anybody we thought would work. We did some comedy, we did this and that, and mostly music, but we threw a few other things in there.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, right now, it's time to hear from one of our sponsors.
This portion of Mountain Stage is brought to you by Big Dip Snuff, the man's dip.
Friends, in today's wine and cheese world, it's important to stay loose and move fast. That's why Big Dip has introduced Light Dip, the dip that tastes great but has only about half the weight of our regular dip. So when you cram a wad of white light
Although the
dip,
show seemed to be more locally focused in the beginning, Ridenour says it wasn't long before Mountain Stage started taking off a bit and was soon attracting nationally recognized talent.
Opportunities came our way in the early days that we didn't expect, or didn't anticipate, I should say. When we were very new on the air, we had only produced just maybe a half a dozen or so shows. We got a letter from a listener in Wheeling, a woman who asked if we would like to have her son on the show. And it was from Mrs. O'Brien.
The Mrs. O'Brien that Ridenour refers to was the mother of Tim O'Brien of the iconic bluegrass group Hot Rise.
My mom said, I wrote to them and said, when are you going to get Hot Rise on there? And she said that they wrote back and said, well, of course we want them, and when can we do that?
Hot Rise's appearance on the show's sixth episode in May 1984 quickly opened doors for the still-infant Mountain Stage, including their first show outside of West Virginia in June 1985.
From Charleston, South Carolina, welcome to Mountain Stage, live from the Piccolo Spoleto Festival with your host, Larry Gross.
It was in Spoleto where the show got its first true taste of the national spotlight.
NPR agreed to
take us on. And one of the things that was dramatic that we did to kind of get their attention was we went and did a show down at Spoleto, and they agreed to let us broadcast live from there. And we used the NPR satellite dish, mobile dish. We were the first ones to use it.
The condition was that we'd have to bring Hot Rise with us, which they were more than happy to do. And so that led us to the realm of being a national program.
We'll come up early, don't leave soon. Play a little bit of your favorites. Have a good time by the light of the moon. Right here in the mountain. We're going to have a good time by the light of the moon. Right here in the mountain. Yeah.
Although Mountain Stage was seeking national distribution and quickly reaching new heights, the State Department of Culture and History threatened to drop out as a co-sponsor and said it didn't want to be associated with the show if it dropped its West Virginia flavor.
I think the people over there wanted us to do only West Virginia acts on the show, but that was never our original intention. We did it for a while because that's all we could get, and we didn't have a choice. But we always wanted to bring in the best people we could get from the very beginning.
Gross says the Charleston community and the O'Brien family rallied in support of the show.
We felt helpless at first, but both newspapers here in Charleston, the Charleston Gazette and the Daily Mail, wrote editorials of Save Mountain Stage. And I know, I'm pretty sure, that Mr. and Mrs. O'Brien, Tim's parents, who were friends and supporters of Arch Moore, contacted him and his wife and Shelley and said, this is a good show.
Governor Moore ordered the agency to restore funding to the show, and Mountain Stage's fate was inevitably saved. And while the O'Brien family helped make that happen, Tim says the show was so good, even in the beginning, that Mountain Stage would have found another way.
I think Mountain Stage would have survived without my mother calling the governor, too, you know. I think it all will work. The good stuff tends to rise to the top and survive, I think.
Ultimately, Mountain Stage persevered and continued to feature world-renowned talent in music as well as other art forms, including the poetry of Allen Ginsberg in February 1986.
Prophecy. As I'm no longer young in life, and there seem to me not so many pleasures to look forward to, how fortunate to be free to write of cars and wars, truths of eras, throw away old useless ties and pants that don't fit.
In April 1986, the show positioned itself for its next big break, this time at the Public Radio Program Directors Conference in San Diego.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome once again to Mountain Stage Live Performance Radio from the Mountain State of West Virginia. But this week, we're coming to you from, I don't know what state it is, I don't know what the mascot is, but it's California and the beautiful city of San Diego, or as we like to remember it, San Diego, home of the Love Boat. We have,
while the show seemed to be growing quickly, resources, especially on the technical side, remained limited. Fisher's assistant engineer at the time, Dave McClanahan, says the trip to San Diego proved the crew had to make do with what they had.
We sent the stuff out in a trailer, and it took 5 days for the equipment to get there. And then when we got there, we had to repair a bunch of the things because being shook around in the trailer for 5 days, a lot of stuff didn't work. So we spent about 4 or 5 hours resoldering some connectors and so forth.
It would take at least 2 days to set up a single production, 2 full working days, and wires running all over the place, this way and that. It was a big spaghetti mess.
Nonetheless, Mountain Stage had a little help out in California from a West Virginia native who was becoming a fast friend and a rising star, Kathy Mattea.
In 85, I hadn't had a hit, and they had me on. And I remember thinking, gosh, these guys are doing this thing out of my hometown. What ambition. How great is this? And then they called and said, hey, we're going to try to go national. So I flew to San Diego. Married up in Abilene, lost a child in Tennessee.
Oh, still that love survived. Around the same time, the Mountain Stage band began to solidify its lineup. Originally including pianist Eric Kitchen and bass player Scott Green, the show soon began recruiting musicians from locally revered band Stark Raven, which, in addition to Bonet and Adams, also included drummer Ahmed Solomon.
It started with Denny and Julie. They were the first in the early days when they were putting the band together. They added the bass, John Kessler, and shortly after they added me.
So that's when I started scheming to be on the show.
Stark Raven guitarist Ron Soul.
Back then they did a lot of comedy, and I knew that doing good comedy takes a lot of time to write. Larry was a great writer, but he didn't have a lot of time. So I started writing some comedy skits and submitted them, and Larry did, I think, just about everything I submitted. So I used to hang out at the rehearsal, just watching them put the skits together. And one day, Larry said, "Hey, I need a harmonica player on the next show." He said, "Hey, you play harmonica, don't you?"
It was maybe a year or so later. They added Ron, and then, you know, we look around and we realize, oh, hey, look, it's Stark Raven.
Being in the Mountain Stage Band was a real education in the breadth of music and styles. And for us, you know, young musicians, being asked to perform with some national acts was definitely inspiring, and also made you really want to work hard and be really good.
The first core of that was we actually knew each other pretty well. And so that was, you know, that was actually really helpful because, you know, when you know each other that well and you play a lot, you kind of have your own language and you kind of read each other's minds a little bit.
Denny Bonet says there was never a lack of creativity.
Once the show started getting more and more popular and we had to come up with more and more music, you know, we kind of kidded around and called it kind of the handy wipes of music, because you would write a song on Tuesday and get to perform it live on national radio by Sunday.
In 1986, Mountain Stage was picked up by NPR on a regular basis. But, as Gross says, getting distribution wasn't exactly easy.
Culturally, most of the rest of the country wants to fit us into yeehaw, get out your fiddle and your banjo, stomp the ground, let's drink some moonshine and play some old-time country music and some old-time mountain music. And there's nothing wrong with that because it's fun. A lot of that, we do some of that, but that's not all we do. And frankly, that's not all West Virginians like. West Virginians are a diverse people. You know, they're not all one type of person, and they like a lot of things.
The Mountain Stage is a brand I'm very proud of now, and we worked very hard to develop that brand. But if in the earlier days, when the show was in its beginning moments of being a national program, I would have fired the person who came up with the name Mountain Stage for the show, because it was such a hard sell in many ways. A show from West Virginia with the name Mountain in it was not an easy sell in a lot of markets around the country. I couldn't fire that person because it was me.
Eventually, the show began to overcome that hurdle, and many program directors started picking up the show, including Rusty Smith of WOUB in Athens, Ohio.
In the late 80s, we were putting on a couple of additional transmitters, and we were rearranging our program schedule. And Mountain Stage had been on the air for a few years, and we had noticed it, you know, across the river whenever we listened to West Virginia Public Radio. And it was a great show, you know, live performance radio. So when we rearranged our schedule in the late 80s, when we increased our broadcast area, we included that as part of a live performance Saturday evening lineup, one of the big parts of that lineup.
In 1987, Mountain Stage found a new home at the Capitol Plaza Theater in downtown Charleston, and continue to reel in some of the biggest names in American roots music, including Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Tony Trischka, Guy Clark, John Hartford, and Townes Van Zandt.
If I needed you, would you come to me? Would you come to me and ease my pain? If you needed me, I would come.
Once we got national and once we got going where we had an audience of some substance, it became a little easier and a little more interesting to try to look for folks who were emerging artists. I remember getting Lyle Lovett's first album and saying, wow, this guy's really good. And so we got him on.
She wore glass slippers. She held her head up high. She had that sparkle at her feet and that twinkle in her eye. She smiled at me.
Mountain Stage began to travel more and more in the late 80s with extended stints on the road, including stops in Washington, D.C., a third stop in Spoleto, and out west as far as Texas.
Birchmere, then Charleston, South Carolina, then Kerrville, Texas. And that was all hands on deck.
As Dave McClanahan remembers it, despite using all their resources and manpower, the Mountain Stage crew had to overcome a few hurdles to make that run of shows happen.
Right before we left, the theater that we had been doing the show in, we were using some of their gear, and the fellow just right before we left told us that we couldn't take his gear. He wanted to sell it to us, and he was asking, well, an exorbitant price, but nonetheless, we couldn't have purchased it on that short notice anyways. We came up with a way to do the house mix from the radio console and literally went on the road not having done it, just on the fly. And it worked, and that's how we did the show for many years after that. It wasn't optimal, but it did require no capital up front, and it required a lot of handstands and extra things for the tech crew to deal with. But it got the show on the air.
Pull in the alley behind a liquor store. Turn down the lights and left the motor running.
At the second of two shows at the Kerrville Folk Festival in June 1988, Gross gave the nod to his old friend and schoolmate, Ray Wiley Hubbard, who says the show was already making quite the impression.
And I can't remember when I first heard it, but I was, you know, really impressed with the caliber of the artists that they had, that there weren't, you know, these just weren't flash in the pan, goober, hotshot, pop guys, that these guys, that the people that he had on had a lot of integrity with their writing and were real musicians. So when he called me up and asked me to be on it, I was very, very, very flattered.
As Mountain Stage carried on, Gross and Company began to mold the show more closely to what it is today.
We started getting experience, we started getting equipment, and then we started feeling our way of, what do we want to do with this show? What is it? We had to start thinking about that. And we ultimately, over a period of years, filtered out everything but the music.
We sort of just transitioned from having that broad palette to really focusing on the music, and then broadening the kinds of music that was going to be on the show.
With talent like Doc Watson, Mose Allison, Taj Mahal, Dr. John, Daniel Lanois, and James McMurtry, virtually all styles of music were being represented on Mountain Stage. Singer-songwriter Jim Lauderdale says the show helped forge a genre in and of itself.
I think it's a forerunner of what we call Americana. You know, before we called it Americana, Mountain Stage, that was kind of the vision they had with the kind of artists they were booking, is what Americana has turned out to be.
I think the Mountain Stage definitely is Americana. You can say it's Americana. You can say it isn't as well, but it would fit that description. I think quite well because what you hear on the Mountain Stage is roots music, is roots influenced, roots oriented music. So you hear mountain music, you hear bluegrass, old timey, you hear blues, the basic Americana styles.
British musician Richard Thompson first appeared on the show in February 1990 as just one name in a long list of more rock-oriented acts that helped push Mountain Stage's artistic boundaries. Broadening of the show's musical styles could even be observed in the evolution of the Mountain Stage Band. In the mid to late 80s, musician and Charleston Gazette contributor Michael Lipton was starting to take notice of the show.
For me, the most interesting music was the music that Mountain Stage was bringing to town. So I started doing previews on the acts that were coming to Mountain Stage. Then I started doing stories on Mountain Stage and talking to Larry. And we became friends, and then I kind of gradually started working on the show.
Lipton first came on as an assistant to Fisher in mixing the show, but soon found himself on electric guitar with the Mountain Stage Band.
I mean, there wasn't even the need for an electric guitarist that much, and then gradually more and more there was. And so I kind of, I guess in my experience, you kind of create a need for your services, and then hopefully you get hired, and that's kind of what happened. I guess I'd like to think I grew into it, you know, kind of with the show.
Although Mountain Stage was reaching nearly 100 public radio stations by the early 90s, the show received a blessing in disguise when WUGA out of Athens, Georgia, decided to drop them.
Gene Craven was then our program director and station manager. And I believe he dropped Mountain Stage for a time.
Rob Holmes, a former program director at WUGA and the host of a local music show at that station.
It didn't last long, but it was absent from our schedule for perhaps a few months. He did hear from listeners who missed it by that time, and I suspect that did include some of the members of the REM team.
Mountain Stage gained a friend in REM guitarist Peter Buck when he came on the show in April 1990 with Kevin Kinney. Hope I'll put your things inside
my trunk. At the end of his set, and I knew who he was, of course. We all knew who Peter Buck was and REM was. He said to me, this is a great show. I really love this show. I'm going to see if my band wants to come play it. And I thought, yeah, right. A while later, Andy came to me and he said, we just got a call from the manager of REM. Would you like to have REM on the show? And I said, any time of day or night, on any day of the week. Of course we want to have REM on the show.
Given REM's stature at the time, Gross and Company made a few accommodations for the band.
And by that time, we had moved back to the Culture Center. But we knew two reasons we needed to go back to the Capitol Plaza. Number one, that's where Peter Buck heard it, and he liked it, so we're going to go back there. Number two, it holds about three times as much audience as the Culture Center. So we plan to go back and do it a little bit differently.
Then associate producer Linda McSparron says the Mountain Stage staff knew that REM's appearance would be a big deal, but says they had no way to fully grasp its impact on the show.
We sold the show out in 9 minutes. Tickets were being scalped for $500 in Columbus. We thought we were just being outrageously overpricing at $20 a ticket, but that's when the show we realized, okay, we're going. Thought that I heard you laughing. Thought that I heard you sing. I think I thought I saw you try.
The Mountain Stage appearance was important for us to do because it was not, it was certainly off of the normal beaten path for a rock band.
REM's band advisor, Burtis Downs.
It was not New York or London or L.A. We went to all those places, but we also went to Charleston, West Virginia, and did the Mountain Stage show in that spring of 91.
After the Out of Time CD, REM had decided not to tour. So all they did was Saturday Night Live, MTV's Unplugged, and Mountain Stage.
It's a high-quality show. It's on National Public Radio in lots and lots of markets. It's a little unconventional in a certain sense, but it's highly respected among musicians and people who listen to NPR. It has a real loyal following. We all are big supporters of WUGA here in Athens, And so it just it seemed like a kind of, if you're going to do the obvious stuff, it's kind of fun to throw in some things that aren't as obvious or that other people might not have thought of.
You know, I can't stress enough the importance of REM doing our show. Just like we were fortunate to have Mrs. O'Brien send us a letter in the early days that gave us Hot Rise on the show, that gave us our first national broadcast, live national broadcast on National Public Radio. REM put us on a map in a whole different way. Because of their appearance on the show, we were on the Today Show, we were in Rolling Stone, we were in all the music magazines.
That's when Andy had to quit calling agents, and it reversed. Everything just flip-flop, and the agents were calling him. And that's when it really changed and became a national radio show that people were, whoa, this is cool, you know. It was always cool, but this was like, it gave us the recognition, the high profile that we needed.
Other guests on the bill with REM included Billy Bragg, Robin Hitchcock, Clive Gregson, and Christy Colliser. Bragg says the show was a bit ahead of its time.
I think Mountain Stage was starting to get a great reputation around that time. You know, and they were putting out the CDs and everything. And, you know, at the time, there weren't so many old-timey theatres that we got to play in. We were still mostly playing in rock clubs. But since then, it seems to be the idea of finding an old theatre and doing it up has caught on around the rest of America. You find more and more now you're playing in those kind of venues where people really appreciate the old space.
As Bragg points out, Mountain Stage had begun releasing best of compilation CDs through Blue Plate Music, a subsidiary of the John Prine-owned Old Boy Records. Label co-owner and producer of the series, Al Bunetta.
It's a quality of recordings that you capture the passion, you capture the reason why these artists are doing it, the level of songs. What a way to get over a thought and a song, and Mountain Stage captures that. It's just incredible. With today's competition, the way they can make records, everybody can make a record in their home, Mountain Stage stands up to anything I've ever heard on a recording or digital delivery system.
Fisher says another co-producer of the series coined a phrase that he feels accurately describes the quality of his and the show's work.
His name was Dan Einstein, and he explained it to me. He said somebody's going to look back at this material and as a lump and view it as the best collection of recorded music for this slice of time. As a collection, the work means something. He described it, and I think he's right. It's Smithsonian-grade material.
...1991 proved to be a watershed year for Mountain Stage, not only because of REM's appearance and the increased attention to the show, but also because Bob Thompson came on to the show full-time, replacing then-recently departed Eric Kitchen in the house band.
At that time, I was doing a lot more traveling with my band and doing things on the road. And so I thought, you know, this would be fun. I'd like to do this for a little while. So I thought maybe I would do it for a year or something like that, and then I would get back to what I was doing. But the longer I did it, the more I enjoyed it.
In addition to expanding the breadth of music represented on the show, Gross & Company carried on through the 90s by making Mountain Stage a haven for artists both young and old.
Quit school, Chief 17. Senator on TV calls her welfare queen.
We've played the smallest, you know, nastiest, stickiest floored bar rooms with the smallest crowds. And we played festivals in, you know, Europe just in front of 70,000 people.
Bottle Rocket's frontman Brian Henneman says the show offers artists something rarely possible in the scheme of regular touring.
It's a great spot in that spectrum. It's cool. It's something different. It's something that reaches more people than normal. You know, how many people may hear a show that we're on Mountain Stage? You don't really know. That's the magic of radio. You know, it's like, it's going to be a lot more people than you'll fit into a little bar room in Birmingham, Alabama or whatever.
One of the things about the show is that
some of the way attitudes we have and the practices we have were formed because I was on many shows. When I had a hit song, as weird as it was, I was on every show of the day. I was on The Tonight Show, The Midnight Special. I was on The Merv Griffin Show. I was on The Rich Little Show. I was on every kind of a show like that that you could have.
And those experiences, says Gross, have left an indelible mark on how Mountain Stage has operated over the years.
What I learned was there are certain ways of treating people that I never wanted to do on Mountain Stage. And then there were other ways that I really wanted to try to emulate.
And artists who have performed on the show have certainly taken notice, like singer-songwriter Robert Earl Keen.
There's a different feeling when you deal with somebody, someone like Mountain Stage. You know, people are truly friendly and open and glad you're there. And, you know, they don't care if you're playing some weird folk tune or you're banging on a cymbal and blowing a kazoo at the same time. It's all about, you know, the enjoyment and the entertainment and the passion behind it, not about the focus group or the numbers. It's always about, you know, bringing the personality to the airways.
Banjo virtuoso Bela Fleck echoes those sentiments.
You feel very welcomed here, and it's not an elitist kind of a situation where I don't know if we can fit you in, or I don't know if you're new music. We got to hear your stuff and see if your new stuff fits. It's a very you feel very welcomed here. It's like, no, you're part of our family, and if you have something new that you think fits, we'll give it a shot. And that's been what's happened so far. Now, I haven't shown up with any ambient noise music based on mosquitoes or anything like that, but we'll see what happens when that happens.
Bluegrass legend Ricky Skaggs says the show's welcoming nature fits in with their home in Appalachia.
Mountain Stage feels like family. You know, when any of us come here, we all kind of feel like we're coming, you know, coming back, you know, coming to people that we love, you know, and I think a big part of that is just that thing here in the mountains. I mean, it's community, it's family, it's friends, and that's the thing I love about Mountain Stage. It really does feel like home. You know, I can't stress how different that is when you go and play a lot of other places.
Mountain Stage had another huge moment in 1994 when one of the world's preeminent roots rock groups came to perform on the show.
The band, by the way, is my favorite band of all time. It's my favorite rock and roll group ever. And in many ways, The Last Waltz is, if you look at that movie, you see the birth of Mountain Stage. I mean, all the acts that are on there, from that well has come a lot of the stuff that's on Mountain Stage. Not everything, but a whole lot of things.
That was the only show that Francis ever missed. And he was out west, and at the last minute, the band was available. And they decided they would go ahead and commit and do the show. And I was tapped to do the radio mix.
And while Gross trusted McClanahan with mixing duties for the show, technical difficulties almost spoiled the plan.
When I came in that Sunday morning, the main console was dead. I mean, dead, no lights, just a complete failed state. And we huddled together, and we decided that the show was going to go on.
That's the way Mountain Stage is. You cannot have it not work. It has to work. So somehow you make it work. And that's what we did that day.
The band returned to the show in 1996, but this time Fisher was there at the helm of engineering. Nazareth. The show stopped broadcasting live in 1996, and the late 90s brought a few changes in personnel for the Mountain Stage Band, as John Kessler and Denny Bonet left to pursue other musical endeavors. Ron Soule took over for Kessler as musical director, and longtime friend Steve Hill was brought in to handle the bass.
Well, I had played music with Ahmed for a long time. You know, I was a guitar player too, and we were in bands together. And Ron and Ahmed and John and I were in a band together. And so we'd had a long time playing music together, and so I was kind of a natural playing bass with the band because of my relationship with Ahmed. So because we just sort of knew what each other was going to do, you know, and so music was much more comfortable that way.
While the show was beginning to stabilize itself musically from an internal standpoint, questions began to surface once again about whether or not Mountain Stage would survive.
Larry would come in and say, well, you guys, you know, I think we'll probably be back, but we're not exactly sure, you know, we haven't got all the money yet lined up, and we've lost some sponsors, and looks like we may gain some sponsors.
Although the show had certainly faced funding issues in the past, in 1999, Mountain Stage found itself in a particularly difficult financial situation. As Ridenour began meeting with advisors of then-Governor Underwood, they asked him what the show needed to continue. After getting help with private funding, the show was left about $200,000 short of what it needed to continue. And then something remarkable happened.
I remember hearing back from one of our supporters who said, listen to the Governor Underwood's State of the State speech tonight. And I said, okay.
Mountain Stage is a huge billboard for West Virginia that helps to attract business and tourism. Currently, this radio program reaches more than 110 stations that serve major markets across the nation. I propose a general revenue line item for the Mountain Stage in the amount of $200,000.
Mountain Stage carried on into the 21st century by sticking to their tried-and-true formula of mixing world-renowned talent with emerging artists. While the highlights are seemingly infinite, Ridenour says a trip to Scotland to kick off the show's 28th season was one of the big ones.
We had Tim O'Brien over there, and we had Mavis Staples and Doogie McLean. But, you know, it was an opportunity to take the show international and spread, you know, spread the good word about Mountain Stage internationally in that way. Our CDs had always sold well in Europe, but it was nice to be able to take the show there.
Also in recent years, guitarist Ryan Kennedy was added to the Mountain Stage Band. By far the youngest member, Kennedy says he relishes the opportunity to play with such an accomplished group of musicians.
It's always really exciting for me. It's always really interesting for me to find out where I fit into it. Trying to see what I can bring. You know, everyone's kind of got their own modus operandi, I guess. And I had to develop my own kind of sense as to where I fit into the band. And they're giving me the freedom to do that, too.
Ridenour stepped down as producer in the fall of 2011, and associate producer Linda McSparren's retirement soon followed. Ridenour's duties were handed over to former intern and then assistant producer Adam Harris.
I had done it for 28 years, and I had done everything I could do with it. It was time for somebody new, some new blood to step in and do it, and we mentored Adam for 2 years to take over, and I was very comfortable walking away. If we didn't have someone like Adam who could have the talents that he has to bring to the table to take it over, you know, I don't know if I would have been as ready and willing to walk away from it.
It's a big deal. It wasn't lost on me. These guys built a legacy, and not many people get to inherit such a legitimate legacy.
With Harris leading day-to-day operations of the show, Mountain Stage has continued to travel more and more in recent years, making stops in Athens, Georgia, Bristol, Tennessee, Grand Marais, Minnesota, among others. Not only does taking the show on the road provide financial security, it also helps engage audiences and spreads the word about the show. Harris says one such trip to Fairbanks, Alaska in August 2012 showed him the power of what they do.
When we went to Fairbanks, it was one of the hottest audiences we've ever had. I mean, they love and appreciate their radio up there, and they love and appreciate Mountain Stage. In the theme, you know, I say, with your host, Larry Gross. And there's still some theme song before we actually cue the audience for applause. They started applauding immediately.
Energy. And by Bailey and Glasser, welcome to another Mountain Stage with your host, Larry Gross.
There's a song in my heart.
You hear that theme song every Saturday come out of your radio speakers.
Lori Neufeld of KUAC in Fairbanks.
And it doesn't always dawn on you that Larry Gross is singing that theme song live to an audience. And so I think that that's part of what made the Fairbanks audience erupt in such hoots and hollers and applause.
While giving the nod to well-established acts and longtime friends during their 30th season, one has to look no further than some of the bright young talent that Mountain Stage featured this past year to realize the show is not only staying relevant, but also thriving. Americana chart topper Jason Isbell says Mountain Stage is a necessary stop to gain a wider audience.
Well, there are always people listening to these kind of shows that haven't ever heard of us before. That's the thing for me. When we're playing our own shows or, you know, something even that's webcast, that's planned, what we're getting is a large number of people who already know who I am and already know the songs and are watching it or listening to it for that reason. And a show like this is going to have a built-in audience that doesn't necessarily know what we're doing, you know. Plus, when you put that many different artists together, somebody might be listening to Stephen Kellogg, you know. They might be tuning in because he's playing, and then they hear us as a side note and wind up liking it. So it's good for me anytime I can preach to somebody besides the choir.
Another of the show's favorites in recent years has been the rock group Dawes, who performed on the show's 800th episode in September of 2013.
Yeah, I feel like our music is steeped in tradition, and there's no way around it, and that's something we're very proud of. We like leaning on our influences, but at the same time, any band's dream is to be reverent to the music that you grew up listening to, but at the same time, having your own thing and making new music and having it feel like new music when people hear it, just so that you can carve out your own space and be your own, have your own identity.
Guitarist and vocalist for the band Taylor Goldsmith says that translates to a musical kinship with the show.
And I feel like Mountain Stage is kind of getting after the same thing. A lot of these artists that we're talking about, they definitely can be associated with certain genres, but not limited to. And I think that's a really important thing. Like you can talk about country and folk and bluegrass, but to call any of these artists just one of those things, or the purveyors of just one of those things, wouldn't be fair to the artist, and it wouldn't be fair to Mountain Stage.
Cause she thinks most people don't talk enough about how lucky they are. Most people don't know what it takes for me to get through the day.
Kentucky native and singing cellist Ben Salee.
I think that overall Appalachia has been very inclusive with other cultures and their styles and their sounds, which is to say that when you get in a holler and the people that live in the holler, they exchange ideas because of the geographical boundaries. And then those ideas kind of incubate in that area and they grow from that area and they become part of the identity of that area. And I think, if anything, Mountain Stage is that. It's an exchange of ideas within a growing community.
The legacy of Mountain Stage is important because of the artists that we've had, but also on our reliance on finding the next big performer. Hopefully finding young talent and bringing it to a broader audience that needs to be exposed to it. And part of our legacy is that we've done that with some artists that were maybe lesser known when they were on our show,
and they've grown up. And a lot of them don't forget that. A lot of them don't forget some of their first national media exposure.
We would have never predicted Mountain Stage would have been here for 30 years. But one of the reasons we are is because we're constantly looking at the future. We're not looking at the past.
And looking to the future, says Gross, means handing over some of the show's direction to others.
In the future, I'm going to step away, and we're going to have some guest hosts come on and do the show. We're going to try some new things, because I won't be here forever. And if the show continues to go, there will be somebody else. And we've got to figure out how that is. That's a tough transition, because the live host is a lot of the personality of the show. And so is the artistic direction. But I'm already starting to hand off some of that, too. I'm telling some of the other folks, the younger folks, saying, hey, you give me some bands.
As for Fisher, well, he has few plans of stepping aside anytime too soon.
I'm going to keep right on doing it until I just finally go deaf and they say you can't come back anymore. I'm working in the library reading the law. I'm working with the papers and brushes and pens. I finish up a job and I'm starting again. I kiss my woman goodbye. I'll be leaving soon. Working at the square dance, playing fiddle too.
Trying to summarize Mountain Stage in their 30 years of live performance radio seems impossible. But if anyone deserves that task, it's two of the show's biggest supporters and most frequent guests, Tim O'Brien and Kathy Matea.
I think they've really stood their ground with a vision for, you know, unlimited choices and anything goes, and if it's good, it works for us. You know, most people nowadays, they would sort of figure out a market research and figure out how they're going to fit in. Instead, they just did what they wanted to do, and people noticed. It's valuable.
It's like maybe we speak the same language or something because we're of the same place. I have to say, though, I feel, I feel really proud of what they've all done and how they represented West Virginia and Appalachian culture, and what they mean to the rest of the world. I mean, just to get to stand up next to them and say, these are my people, and, you know, this is what I love about music and culture and life and connections. And, you know, I feel my chest swell a little bit, you know, whenever I think about it.
You've been listening to Mountain Stage at 30, a radio retrospective. This program was produced by Dave Mistich and co-produced by Patrick Stevens. Additional audio for interviews by Chuck Frostick. Special thanks to Larry Gross, Andy Ridenour, Francis Fisher, Adam Harris, Linda McSparron, Jeff Shirley, Vasilia Skouras, Josh Saul, the Mountain Stage Band, and all the members of the staff and crew over the years, and of course, all of the artists who have appeared on the show over the past 30 years. Thanks also to WOUB in Athens, Ohio, WUGA in Athens, Georgia, KDRP in Dripping Springs, Texas, KUAC in Fairbanks, Alaska, and WAMU in Washington, D.C. Thanks for listening.